But as a Christian, why should I not sneak out and hide behind a bush and knock him off?
Because God loves that man just like he loves you, and he wants that man to experience the love of Christ also. And, you don't have any right to take his life because he's a child of God.
How do I know that?
The Bible tells us
that he is a child, that God has made him, and that I'm not to take his life. The Bible tells me so, right?
Right.
That's how I know. And I know that I'm not to take his life. Can I cut that out? Or shouldn't I just go mop up on him?
It's against the law. You'll go get thrown in jail.
But suppose I'm smart and sneaky and catch him out in the field where there's nobody.
You still deny him of his basic human right. That would be like someone saying, deny you of yours.
But what right does he have?
He should have as much right to live as you.
Why?
Why not?
Why? That's right. You end up with a...
What is a right?
Yeah. What is a right?
What's right?
So
you need an authority.
Now, he might kill you first. That's a good reason for doing him out. As a matter of fact, if I don't believe in a God, ultimately it works out too. Anybody that gets in my way just better look out. If I've been raised nice, I might be nicer. But if I've not been, I know a fellow, a personal experience. A man once offered to a friend of mine who had done him a favor. Once told his friend, "Now look, if you ever want anybody knocked off, I'll do it for $15. That'd be about gas. So usually I charge a whole lot more than that. But I'll kill him for $15. And my friend went, "We're out of here." See, man's just no more than one way to respond.
Yeah, there's no value on man. There isn't a God. You know, he's what gives meaning and value to everything. It's all based on him.
Right.
He's the foundation for everything.
And this is why, gang, this is why we, in terms of apologetics, we have a stranglehold on the world. The world without God has no meaning. We'll show that in a few minutes, a little more fully. But do you catch this? Non-Christians can't live with that. Christians can. I can live consistently with my presuppositions and be a fuller and fuller and fuller human being. God is changing me. But if I'm a non-Christian and I really am going to live consistently, then I have to turn into an animal. And that denies the things that are inside of me that say, no, that's not right. Do you want to know Romans 2? 14 and 15 and 16 points. Scripture says that even the non-Christian is going to be without excuse. Somebody read that. Go ahead, 14, 15, 16.
For the Gentiles which have not the law, through by nature of things, continue the law, these having not the law, are law and concerns. But show the works of the law written in hearts, in conscience also of his lips. May thoughts and meaning are appeared by us, excluded from us. And the day when God shall judge the secrets of men by Jesus Christ according to us.
Even the non-Christians have the law of God written in their hearts. In that conscience. Conscience can be swelled, seared, and chopped up in little bits. But you got to do some work on it. And you'll find guys on campus never begin to see their presuppositions working out. No, man, that's just not right. That's right, it's not right. I'll tell you why. Okay. These are Schaefer's basic intentions. Only Christians can live a life consistent with their presuppositions. This makes me bold. It does. It doesn't make me overbearing. See, turkey? I can live a life consistent with my presuppositions. No. But I have a reason. No one else does. They can cook up reasons. But eventually they just sort of cave in because there's no foundation. What we're going to be doing is demonstrating they don't have a foundation. Schaefer's basic approach in showing in his arguments in his books is this. What he'll usually do is note a characteristic of the universe. A philosophical problem. The second thing, he'll present two hypotheses. Sometimes there'll be more than two. Guess what hypotheses they'll be for explaining this characteristic of the universe? Right. The atheist,
of God.
The atheist and the Christian. By atheist, I don't mean just someone who doesn't like God. I mean someone who believes that all there is just matter, and that's it, matter and motion. That's all there ever has been. The atheist and then the Christian. Then, he'll demonstrate, actually demolish would be a better word, but first, to show that it can't live up to explaining life, both the universe and why I have meaning and purpose in life. Then, he'll demonstrate the adequacy of the Christian. Of a Christian explanation. And the thing he'll repeatedly say is, it has the ability to explain more data. With less problems. And on the basis of that, it's a lot better set of presuppositions than the atheist. He sort of proceeds along a little bit of a scientific hypothesis kind of thing. Okay, we got this in the universe, now let's see. There can be two basic approaches to why this exists like it does. There is no God, and all there is just matter, time, and chance. Or there is a God who has done things purposefully in the universe. And then he just, you know, blows a person out of the sky and leaves a second. Shows how it's adequate to explain. That's a little bit racy explanation, but that's what he does. And that's what he, that's what he does, especially in three categories. Number one, metaphysics. This, why is there anything? One fellow I know is considering the philosophical question of why is there air. Came to conclusion, any phys ed major knows that. Blow up bottle bottles. Now, why is there anything? Metaphysics. He contends, number one, atheism can't account for, that's A. Atheism cannot explain the existence form and complexity of the universe. And personality of man. Then he'll state Christianity can. Okay, and epistemology is how do I know anything? How do I know I'm here? How do I know you're there? How do I know we're talking? You know, this whole theory, that the theory of how we know and the limits of knowledge. He says that atheism can't account for it, cannot account for knowing. And guess what? at that quote. Christianity can. In the area of morals, atheism can't explain why man is both good and bad, is noble, yet cruel. Christianity can. This is an outline of what we're going to do in a few minutes. I want to show you how he does that, so that you can use it for wills. You follow me on this? Okay. You tell me for about 3 or 4 minutes. Some good questions in this area. What kind of questions do you encounter? Or have you asked, or do college students ask, that would fit in this category of metaphysics? Why is there anything? How do you phrase it? How do your friends phrase questions in this area? You're going to talk about how to deal with them. I'd like us to categorize them. How do you hear questions and why is there anything? How do you hear them phrased? Basically, what I hear is, simply enough, and I just can't figure out why we're here. I can't figure out, you know, here are people and here are dogs, what's the difference? You know, I don't feel like a dog, but go ahead.
In
life. That fits in this category. After a good heavy evolutionary science course, a lot of people are trying to figure out why they're any better than, you know, the cheetah. a Tarzan and cheetah. Why do I have significance more than all the rocks around me?
Cheetah didn't take the course.
Cheetah feels a lot better about the whole situation. How about epistemology? Okay, this is the section of study that deals with how do I know about anything? What are the limits of knowledge? Sort of that kind of thing. Let me toss out something to you and see if you've heard it. How do I know, I did it a few months ago, how do I know I'm here? Okay, how do I know whenever I touch this thing that it's really there?
The old analogy of a man dreaming of a butterfly, is the butterfly dreaming of the man, or is the man dreaming of the butterfly? That's something that's been realized. She was.
That one crops up. Who's doing the dream? You ever seen some of those weird films that make occasionally about the guy who wakes up, he's had this dream and he wakes up, and probably so glad it's over, and things go on and they get worse and he wakes up again. So glad, and it keeps on waking up from dream to dream to dream. Is all that we're doing just an infinite series of dreams? Okay, how do you know there's a God? Well, that would be it. Have you ever gotten into the one of, how do I know that we're talking about the same thing? Can we really communicate? You know, are you thinking the same thing in your head that I'm thinking whenever I say, Corvette. Can we really communicate? We might get some of these down. So whenever you go back over your notes, you'll know what category you're dealing with. Have you run into a question? You run down the list and say, yeah, that's right there. I go over here. What are some others? Okay. And how can I be aware of the spiritual? That would sort of be in that category. Another thing is, well, I just feel like this is true. Here's some of the brothers saying this case. I just feel like it's so. Is that an adequate basis for saying, I know it's true? I know it is true. How about morals? What kind of questions do you hear in this category?
Why is there so much evil in the world? If God is supposed to be good, why doesn't he stop some of this evil?
Okay, why doesn't God stop evil? Okay, why do you start people? Stop people starting. One I hear all the time is there are no absolutes. Mm-hmm. One of our students asked a teacher, he said that. Are you absolutely sure? And the guy backed off. Well, there could not be any. You know, there's a possibility there are no absolutes.
God didn't want to do something, why would he put it in the world? He didn't want
to smell
white
as
it's
bigger
in the world.
Okay. What basis is there for morals?
Why is, when they were changing over to co-ed dorms at ISU, a lot of the questions came up, you know, why is your moral standard of wanting to have your boyfriend overnight in your room any better than my moral standard of not wanting you to have your boyfriend overnight in your room on my floor?
Aren't all morals just relative?
Just the whole idea of we're striving for a certain thing. Well, what's to say that the opposite of that isn't just as equally as good? Like we try to alleviate suffering in the world, well, what's the matter with suffering? Well, why isn't that good?
Why can't I do what I want to? Another one I hear out in classrooms, morals are just a reflection of the society they occur in. The culture determines the morals. Yeah. One of my favorite pushing points there is Hitler's destruction of 6 million Jews with the approval, the fair approval, of a significant part of the population of Germany. Thought it was great. And I'll ask people, so there's nothing wrong essentially with that, was there? You burn 6 million people, husbands, wives, little babies. What they say. Okay, now.
I thought that was true with a girl the other night. She found it. Well, I guess there's not anything wrong with that. She had to say that in order to defend her position. But I needed it inside.
I've done that before. Okay. These are the kinds of things you're going to be dealing with in the next session. Let's take about a 7 or 8 minute break. Go out and run a lap around the building. Stick your head under the water fountain. Look at the outline again. The sheet there.
Sorry.
Scaring to death. Take a look at the sheet. I want to do 4 things quickly. I want to go through them and then clarify and apply those to your own wits. One of them I want to talk about, that history of development of Western thought that we talked about earlier. I'm going to come to your sheet in just a second. History of the development of Western thought. Second, how Schaeffer demolishes atheism and metaphysics. How he does it in epistemology, how he does it in morals. Then we want to apply that to your situation. Okay? Now, your outline. I've got a little parable there for you. This is a parable of what's happened in Western thought. Something happened about the year 1200 that has changed the course and of history and has led to the development of the situation we have now.
Once man and the meaning of life lived in the same country. While all was not well, all did have meaning. Then one night an earthquake occurred. Man awoke to find he was separated from the meaning of life. Remembering what he had learned about the meaning of life, man lived happily for a time. But questions gradually began to bother him. Why did this happen? Why is this more important than that? Puzzled, man decided to build a bridge back to the meaning of life. He just wants to get answers. Now, the land had only one kind of building block, building material, called particulars. So man begins to use the one tool that he had, an antithesis, saw, trying to shape the particulars into blocks to build a bridge that would span this gap back to the meaning of life. But the blocks kept falling apart. He couldn't shape them so they'd hang together over that chasm. One day a friend dropped by and seeing the tall discouragement, don't try to ask why, just ask how. Be content to ask how. Cheered by the thought of a vacation, the man stopped work. But soon the haunting questions returned. Happily, another friend passed by and suggested a new approach. Here's some special glue. I call it synthesis because it sticks things together so well. Take the particulars and glue them together into a bridge. Eagerly, the man set about the task. At first, things went well as he glued the smaller particulars together. But under the weight of the large ones, the glue always snapped and the pieces fell into the chasm. Desperation began to set in when another man walked by. Tools won't help you reach your goal. There's no way to bridge the gap. You must leap to it. The man surveyed the foreboding gulf. Noticing his hesitancy, the traveler hurriedly said that he had made the leap and found it was not as far as it looked. Hope raised again. The man asked, you've been there? Then what is the meaning of life? I can't express it in words. You must find it for yourself, he said. Driven by the tormenting desire for meaning, the man decided to try. In the twilight, he made a few practice broad jumps. Darkness was complete as he ran full speed for the cliff. Straining with all his might, he sprang into the dark. Only one question haunted him. Why didn't he tell me what it was? Damp night breeze bathed him. He plunged down into the darkness. What's the sequence of action here? Earthquake and separation from the meaning of life. Schaefer says that Thomas Aquinas represents an earthquake in the history of Western thought. Who knows who Aquinas was?
Roman Catholic
theology
wrote a big theological thing, trying to
summate everything up. Yeah, he was an encyclopedia maker. Go ahead. He was an encyclopedia maker, going to sum everything up, the giant encyclopedia, theology and nature and all this stuff. Well, Aquinas did a couple of things that have had consequence since around the year 1200 on down into the present. He made two contributions that have affected the history of Western thought. Number one, Aquinas proposed that man's will fell at the Garden of Eden, but not his intellect. An incomplete fall of man. Now, practically, what that meant was that man could reason his way and know all he needed to about God from reason. Revelation was nice, but man still had all the batteries it took to reason his way to God. He could do it just from looking at nature. And second, he initiated a basic dichotomy, a basic gap between all the physical things in the universe, like you and me and this chair and trees and dogs and rocks and things like that, and me. He set a gap between the physical realm of the universe, the particulars, all these little particular things around here, and that's the physical realm, and the non-physical realm, universals, the things that tie it all together to give meaning to life. He just sort of cast things in those two categories. And because of his great confidence in man's reason, there is some hope generated. Now, the years that he wrote, everything, the church and the state were one. Everything was tied up in religion. There is some hope that reason, thesis, antithesis, reason. Explain that in a moment. Plus, data, the data of the universe, just looking around all these particulars around them, would give meaning, would give purpose, universals, things that are just tied all together for us. This is Aquinas. Everything was all religious anyway. Just set man's reason free to run by itself. But something happened after Aquinas. Before Aquinas, man's interest primarily lay in the heavens, all the great heavens. Out there where it all was, with the saints and with all the angels, that was what was important. And the earth, well, that was sort of dirty and nasty. A contrast a little bit later occurred. There's a diary of a fellow, two men riding along, one out of a monk, meditating on his sins, on the saddle of his horse, meditating on his sins. They ride along past this beautiful lake. All the trees are reflected in the skies, blue, and the clouds are showing. And the one guy is just enthralled by this glorious scene. They're riding along in silence. They get to the destination. And he says to the monk, "Did you see that beautiful lake?" They've been riding by for about 45 minutes. The monk says, "What lake?" Not even saying, "I was meditating on my sins. I was doing the important. The heavenly is important to nature, naturalism." But after Aquinas, the Renaissance occurred. It didn't happen in one night, as you know. A period of many years, man began to develop this interest in nature. Aquinas had sort of brought about two categories: grace, or the universals, God and his revelation, and nature. Schaeffer says that painting reflects this. Before Aquinas' time, there are all these flat, sort of flat figures. Maybe you've seen them. They sort of weird-looking, two-dimensional figures. And all around them, you never see rocks and trees and hills. There are all these sort of funny-looking bush-type things. They're symbolic representations of nature. But after Aquinas, Giotto, you've had our appreciation. Giotto was a transition figure. He began to paint nature like it was, real, rather than just symbolic. And man began a real interest in nature. Over a period of time, this grew to where the supernatural was just rejected. Aquinas sort of set things free. All we need is reason, plus data, and we can work out meaning. Need our rational reason. But by the time of Newton and others, God had been sort of excluded from the universe, and all that was left was giant clockwork. What happens next in the parable? The guy keeps working his antithesis song. I told you I was going to tell you what that is. A thesis is saying A is not equal to not A. That is, I am me, you are you. I am not you, you are not me. Or, this is right. It's opposite, it's wrong. You have either this or this. I have a choice of two ways. I choose one or the other. Later on, a development occurred where everybody sort of said, well, it's both and. Talk about that in a moment. But it's a thing's either right or it's wrong. It's either true or it's not true. A divided thinking. So man tries to, use a little saw and shape all this stuff and put it together into a way back to meaning. But it doesn't work. What's next? What's next in your parable? Next is a guy who comes along and says what? Now, men began to be aware that if this whole thing really is a giant machine, then all I am is a cog in the machine, and I have no more meaning than just a cog in the machine. So they begin to rephrase the question about meaning. Well, we can't really talk about these ultimate things, but what we can do is talk about determinism versus freedom. We need to figure out a way why we are valid individuals if the whole world is just this giant clockwork. So they sort of redefine the problem. Just ask how it all works together. Don't ask why. Why is the purpose and meaning? Rousseau is that transition figure. Okay, next is Hegel. We're still sort of functioning on this hope. But by the time of Hegel, men have begun to despair of getting this thing together. They weren't getting meaning. The more and more they worked on this thing, how can I be free, and that there still be this mechanism in the universe, the giant clock, the more and more they're coming to the conclusion that we're just a cog in a big machine. By Hegel's time, people were beginning to despair of being able to put it together. So Hegel suggested a new approach. You take a truth and its opposite, and you arrive at a new truth. That's synthesis, the putting together of opposites. We broke the unit's law. You can have a good thing. Take a truth and its opposite, and you arrive at a new truth. Synthesis. We're right here. Rousseau. French thinker Rousseau. I think that's how you spell it. I haven't had French yet. Hegel, what Hegel tried to do was provide a new way of thinking in order to get at meaning. So hope comes up again. That we still have data plus synthesis. Notice, synthesis is still trying to use reason, just like up here. But it's a change in the way you come to. We're still trying to use our minds, but we're doing this juggling act now. Well, it's true, but it's not true. Have you ever had people say to you, well, now that's okay, it's true, that may be true for you, but it's just not true for me. Well, they're functioning with synthesis. That can't be. It's either true or it's not true. It can't be both things.
That's
the
way then that
like
situation ethics kind of came up.
It grows out of this. So you see, this has had an impact on the way we think. And man has not thought the same way since. Modern man has no way of arriving at ultimate truth. We just can't. Things are both and now. So we've got this new thing pops up, and we hope that synthesis is going to glue it all together into meaning. The next fellow is Kierkegaard. Kierkegaard, Danish thinker, came to the conclusion that reason offers no hope. There's no way you're going to be able to start with these particulars and end up with a bridge over to meaning. Instead, you're going to have to make this leap. Somehow, you're going to have to just assume meaning or assume you have meaning. The irrational is the only way. Notice what's happened. We've gone from reason now to non-reason. A leap needs to occur. Different men have proposed different kinds of leaps. The way to achieve meaning. Jaspers said we need to seek some kind of an experience. Carl Jaspers. A final experience. an irrational thing. It doesn't have any thought connected with it. I just have this, you know. Suddenly I've had a final experience, and now I have meaning in life. And you say to me, well, what was it that gave you meaning? I had it, you know. I don't know what it was, but I had it. And now I have meaning. That's one of the big questions.
Only he could know.
That's right. And that's one of the big problems.
Because we get to his own decision, the final experience is going to be death.
That's what Sartre said.
Oh.
Sartre says, Jean-Paul Sartre, that one needs to do an act of the will. Any act of the will affirms that you are a being. Just do something. You know, shoot your mother-in-law. And so it doesn't matter. Pet puppies. You know, anything, as long as you're doing, as long as you will to do it, then you are affirming that you're alive. You're authenticating yourself. And Sartre himself said, the logical conclusion of all this is death is the final experience. But please don't commit suicide. You know, go around hoping that something's going to give you the jazz. But probably it's going to be death. As you can see, everybody's getting in a hole right here. That's what happens to the other pair, you see. Heidegger, Martin Heidegger. Initially identified the right kind of leap with a feeling of angst. Anybody got German? Anguish. You know, a giant toothache of the soul. This foreboding of dread. If I can achieve that, then I'm authenticating myself. I have made the right kind of leap. They'll provide me. I go around with a world hurt of the agony. So this will provide me. Later on, he said it was language. Language did not tell you about being, but it indicated there was being there. So in fact, I can say words. But in all this, these guys are locked in now. They have meaning up here. And they have reason down here. Okay, up here, we have meaning. The only way to get to meaning now is go irrational. It's the only way to come through. And so the guy in the parable goes running for the Gulf, you know, leap the Grand Canyon. That's where modern man is. He operates with his reason, thesis, antithesis, or synthesis, whatever, on what he sees in the universe. He always comes up as zero. I can add two and two, but it doesn't tell me why I'm here. I might solve the complexity of the whole, you know, DNA, RNA scheme. But it won't tell me why I'm here. I can make $1 million, but it won't tell me what to do with it. For our ultimate purposes, why I'm here. The only way I can do that is just hope. I'm going to go around one day until finally I stick my finger in an electric socket somewhere. And now I have any purpose in life. I can't tell you what it is, but I have it. So this is the way things have developed. Your friends on campus have no meaning if you'll get them to operate on reason, looking at that around here, how they always come here. And modern man is that. And the arts show it. How many of you love modern art? Okay, got an appreciator over here. Modern art basically says, if you look at it, it's just confused, isn't it? There are vague impressions, and you can't really tell what it is. And what they're saying is they are reflecting what's inside modern man. Just, it's a picture of what's going on. No reason, no purpose, no pattern. It's just there. In talking to this kind of people, then Schaefer says, okay, I take your system and your way of doing things and compare it with mine. And he goes through some arguments. you have a question on this first, this little history of development? It goes, the big points are Aquinas, the giants. Aquinas, who sets reason free, to reason its own way to meaning. And with that right-wrong approach to reason, that doesn't work out. So Hegel comes in, and he says, well, let's do the both-and. Let's see if we can't work it out that way again. You know what I mean? The next one is Kierkegaard, who says, there is no way with reason. We just must. He can't even tell you what you must do, really. You just have to think. Reason has nothing to do with it.
Harold, you might just prefer to have him stick over into the liberal theology, the belief in the dark, being what the concept of faith is. And the Christian faith is not a leap in the dark.
Okay, good. How many of you have heard the leap in the dark deal? You ever heard that term? Okay, men, whenever this thing occurred back in the 1800s, Darwin was chewing away on the Bible on this end, Newtonian science was chewing away on the other end. Everybody's chewing on the Bible, trying to get it all torn up into shreds. A lot of men began to turn toward Kierkegaard's, or Hegel's and Kierkegaard's view of things. See, meaning lies beyond the touch of reason, purposeless. And this philosophy began to creep into the Christian faith. You have today modern, some branches of Christianity that are the new liberal theology, New Orthodoxy and some others, where faith itself has no contact with reason or with data. I just have faith in God. And what these men will tell you is that things don't work out. You know, if Jesus, you can't really prove whether or not he came out of the grave. It's not important. What other things? Have you said in New York, Rossi?
They don't believe in the miracles of the Bible and stuff.
Miracles of the Bible? No, they don't really have.
Wouldn't Kierkegaard say that all that is important is your relationship to God, and don't worry about whether or not he exists, just worry about how you feel in relation to him?
I stand in the circle of life, and I see around me all of nature, and it doesn't add up to anything in the darkness beyond. Schaefer parallels this to a guy being caught in a snowstorm up on the side of a mountain, and he knows he's going to be frozen to death. And he walks over to this cliff, you know, 10,000 feet up in the Alps, and walks over this cliff and says, well, maybe there's a ledge down there about 10 feet that'll hide me from the cold. How would you feel about doing something like that? Never been there before. Can't see 10 feet below him. Maybe there's a ledge there. Now, he jumps against reason. Now, the Christian approach to faith, see, this man has faith. He's just going to assume, hope that something's there and then jump. He has no reason to believe it's there. The Christian approach is this. We're caught in the snowstorm up on the side of the mountain. We're freezing to death. We see our need of something else. And a voice comes through the snowstorm and says, I know where you are, and I know the area. Down below you, about 10 feet, is a ledge. If you'll get down there, you'll be out of the wind, and you can last till the morning near the snow will let up. What would be your reaction? Who are you? Well, I live around here. Well, what's your name? Oh, okay, yeah, I know your dad. Yeah, we've lived around these parts for years. And you can dialogue and ask questions of the voice in the snowstorm. Now, whenever you come out to the edge and you hang over, you know, still right that last, maybe that last second, you wonder, you know, you don't see the ledge. But whenever you let go, you've got evidence. There is still the step of faith, but it's faith based on evidence now. I'm not totally convinced, absolutely 100% I'm going to hit the ledge. You know, there's still that element of trust. I've got to trust the voice of the song. But I can dialogue and ask questions of it. And we can ask questions, see, of God. Remember, God comes to us with problems. Christianity, science, you look at nature. Look at the Bible. Look at the life of your Christian, your brother, one living close to you, and see the difference. Now, that won't just drive you over the ledge with conviction. This is right. Because whenever you trust Jesus, you always come to think, good grief. And then you commit your life to him. But it's on the basis of evidence. So liberal theology today would say, you don't need evidence. Evidence, that doesn't matter. Just trust. Maybe there's a ledge down there. Look out below. But the Bible says, I'll check it out. Ask questions. Now, the strange thing is, some brands of real warm Jesus people are real similar to the Orthodoxy at that point.
What's that?
Some brands of Jesus people are real similar to the same viewpoint. Oh, brother, it doesn't matter. You don't have to know all this stuff. Just believe. Well, that's not what Luke 14:25-33 says. So better sit down and think this thing through. Yeah?
I don't know which area of the scripture, but one of my friends, he accepted Christ.
If I were dealing with him, I just encourage him to read it for himself. You just get it, check it out yourself. You know, get the facts. Here, read this, and this. I begin at that point.
What would Schaefer say about, granted, it's not a good approach, but I can see where it would sometimes work. You're just jumping off. If the, you know, if the ledge is there, you know, whether you see what I'm saying? That approach might win some people. Because, you know, if they just, you know, do just trust, but then will that give them problems later on?
What do they trust?
Yeah, well,
see, that's the question. What do you trust? Just the great whoever that's out there? Okay. Well, the world thinks a lot of whoevers are there. You even end up leaving worship that way. 1 Corinthians 10:20 says, our worship's offered to idols, there are demons to receive it. So a vague trust, no, there's a certain amount of information. That's why we carry the good news to people. So that's what the faith comes by, the hearing of the word in Romans 10:17. Do you have another follow-up? So we don't make a blind leap into the dark. We still have to trust God. There's still like 4 feet we've got to drop. But whenever we let go, we can ask questions. Okay, let's look at some arguments real quick. And then I want you to develop your own arguments. We're working with those. We're going to do this in the order. Observation, hypotheses, reject the atheistic, and then show the Christian. I'll show you how this is done. The first one is in the area of metaphysics. This is the way Schaefer handles things. The observation. The universe has order. It is not chaos. Why? Also, universe has I'll put it this way, human personality appears to be real.
keying on is the second person. Mistaking my notes. Human personality appears to be real. Why? Okay. Hypotheses. Let's take your set of hypotheses and my set and compare them. Hypothesis number one. Where did it all come from? Where did this whole universe come from? Persons, everything. Out of nothing. Or two, out of impersonal beginning. Find that in a second. And three, out of a personal beginning. Where did the whole universe come from? The universe that has me, a human person, and rocks, non-persons. That has all this order to it and everything. Where did it all come from? Well, there are three hypotheses. One says nothing. There's just nothing, period. Zero. And all of a sudden, there's the universe. With form, motion, all this stuff going on. Schaefer says, garbage. You can't support that. No rational argument will support it. Just the universe with no one there or anything. The second, so he just rejects that. That's silly. Universe came out of nothing. Not matter, not energy, motion, or personality. This is zero. The other is impersonal beginning. That is time plus chance plus the impersonal. No persons were a man. Produced the universe. That's evolutionary atheism. Matter just was, and over a period of time, it sort of got more complex than we all appeared. Things have come out since then. There is no person behind the universe, it's just matter. Matter and motion. The other is a personal beginning, a God created. Person who is there, created. And this is one you usually encounter in the classroom. This is one we hope. How do you reject the atheist hypothesis? How do you disprove it? The essential thing is this results in reductionism. That means man is reduced to zero. Man is truncated. What about truncated limits? You ever have a truncated cone in geometry? It's one of those funny looking cones that's got the top sliced off. Man's cut short what he ought to be. Stretch a second. You guys look pretty weird. Stretch a second, sit back. Okay, if somebody comes to me and says, I don't believe that there is a God, the universe just exists and that's it. Where did it come from? Well, matter, you know, the whole thing. Star explodes, universe shrinks down, explodes again, we have the whole deal. Resulting. And I say, well, what does that have to say about human personality? You know, you are a person. But you're a personality, aren't you? Well, where did personality come from? You know, there's no persons back here. You just have matter and little atoms banging around and everything. Where did personality come from? Okay, there are three things they might say. One is, personality is not real. Well, personality is not real. It just looks like it is. I think I say that. There are some things against that. There are three things that militate against rejecting personality as real. That's not real. If personality is not real, then Where did all your desires for fulfillment, we mentioned this probably, where did all your desires for fulfillment and for love and meaning come from? You have those, don't you? Well,
yes.
You want to be significant, don't you? Well,
yes.
You want to rule the world, don't you? Make a contribution?
Well, yes.
Where did that come from? It is unexplainable that out of that this evolution will go on and produce these in a creature whenever they don't have any relationship to the universe. My aspirations have nothing to correspond to the universe. Man's desire for love and beauty is unexplainable. These don't have any survival value. There's nothing in evolution that would make me believe that, or that makes it necessary for me to really like art to survive. If I were an art student. Do you see what I mean? Evolution goes on the basis of the survival of the fittest. Actually, these desires for love and meaning and occasionally even courage, they are actually the self-deceiving desires, ultimately unfulfilled. These desires have no meaning whatsoever. How could you have come to exist? Number one rejection is you can never be fulfilled. Let's put it that way. Let's put it this way. There's no explanation for origin, our desires. And all these other things that transcend us, that produce art and music. Actually, they're self-deceiving desires. They lead you to desire something that can never be fulfilled. Okay, a second thing that's against it is the testimony of man's history. Let's say the testimony of man. As far back as we can remember, as far back as we can see with archaeology now, man has been buried, his people, with flower petals, with shell beads. Man sees that somehow he's different from a rock. They don't throw rocks at folks with flower petals. There's just something different. Man has always seen himself as different from not me. He's something better, something higher. So it goes against sort of our whole history. History just says man something different. Third, no one can really, and this is most powerful, no one can live consistently with this, to say that my personality is not real. Your aspirations are too strong. You have a desire for meaning, you try to figure out why there's a reason to do that. You have a desire for love. There are people who say that marriage is only sex. I run into people like that. Marriage is just sex. But they go from marriage to marriage looking for something more. So your own aspirations are too strong. They'll deny it. So the fellow we're talking to says, well, okay, I'll agree. Personality is real. I've got these drives and all, and I can't explain it if personality is not real. But personality is real. But I still say there is no person behind the universe. There is no ultimate personal reality in the universe. No God. We've still got this matter now. It's just personality is real. I'll agree to that. Personality is real, but it has an impersonal origin. Again, you've got three problems here. You got this thing again. Who man is? Man's highest aspirations, if you're saying this, man's highest aspirations are unfulfillable. If this is true. Still got that problem. Man is meaningless. He's a personality for sure, but he doesn't have any more meaning than the rocks. As a matter of fact, rocks are even better. You know why? Yeah, a rock at least lived and lived up to being a rock. It is fulfilled in its position in nature. Man is not. That makes man out to be less than a rock. He is less fulfilled than a rock. Pretty serious place to live. You can never be what you desire to. You're out of place in the world.